Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Shizing, please help me. Please come get me.
It's a distress call. Plea for help, a mayday. If the count is right, it's been playing over and over for 16 years.
Someone else stranded here?
Guys, where are we?
That's a clip from the ABC TV series Lost, which debuted in 2004. And for those of you who have been stranded on your own mysterious island for the past 15 years and haven't seen it, let me tell you, Lost is a groundbreaking show about a group of plane crash survivors who find themselves stranded in the South Pacific. Javier Grillo Marx-Watch worked as a writer and producer on Lost for the show's first two seasons. He writes about his experiences in a book called Shoot That One. Javier tells us why the first season of Lost was such a breakout hit.
And one of the reasons that the show turned out the way it did is that there wasn't a lot of time to second guess anything on it. It was a massive leap of faith in JJ and in Damon that ABC ordered the pilot, because they quite literally ordered it off of an outline. There had been a previous script in development with this premise, and then the script wasn't well received, so they threw out the script. And around January, around the time when most pilots have been written and picked over for 6 months and they're getting picked to go to film, was when JJ and Damon turned in this outline. We were racing to get the show done. We were writing. We were casting off of the same sides for different characters. We were buying the fuselage of an L-1011 before there was like a complete script and sending it to Hawaii. So it was one of those things where it was all done in this heat of the moment in a way that I think caught a strange kind of alchemy. It caught a strange kind of lightning in a bottle. All of these very talented people suddenly being thrown into this extraordinarily high-pressure situation. And I think this is one of those cases where, you know, the development process, I've seen development work really well. I've seen it create great hit shows. I was at NBC as an executive the year that ER was developed, and that was a show that benefited enormously from traditional network development. And yet, this is a show that completely came out of left field, and somehow that magic happened. And I think part of it was that there was just no time to second guess what we were doing. We sat in a room for months trying to come up with a mythology for the show and all of that. We went through all the crappy ideas. We came up with some good ones, threw them in. And ultimately what came out of all of that chaos was this little sort of jewel. You know, I'm proud of it because when you think about the way that TV drama has existed traditionally, like you're talking about 24 episodes or 22 episodes a year, you know, and they're all anthologized and all of this stuff. And we were working in a paradigm that was, you know, a little bit of both. The network expected us to do a story of the week show. We knew we wanted it to be serialized, and there was this tension going on there. We had to do 22 of them. It wasn't like now where you can do 10 or 13 and call it a season, you know? So for me, part of the pride I feel on that is that we were able to take a very traditional model of network storytelling and turn it on its head completely.
We need to push the button.
No, we don't.
Did you not hear me, brother? I crashed your bloody plane.
How did you manage to do that?
On that day, those numbers turned to hieroglyphics. And when the last one came down, this whole place started to shake. And that screen filled up with system failure. System failure. And that number there, 92204, September the 22nd, 2004. The day your plane crashed is real. It's all bloody real. Now push the damn button.
I know what I saw. It's a lie. It's not real. None of it is real.
You don't want to push the button, then I will.
No.
I worked on a show called Boomtown a few years earlier, and I think that that's the closest that any traditional network show had come before Lost to really just taking the tropes and, you know, putting them in a bucket full of stones and shaking it up and seeing what came out the other side, you know?
Yeah. Can you give me a few examples of some of the ideas that you and the other members of the Lost think tank came up with?
Well, look, the biggest one is this. The pilot had these micro flashbacks to the airplane, right?
Yeah.
And one of the ways that we thought we would really, really get in the heads of these characters was by creating these very detailed backstories for them, you know? Mm-hmm. And those were very much crafted by those four writers in that room. You know, we sort of ran ideas by JJ and Damon, and then we would get in there and would really dig in very deep. And it came to a point where we were trying to break stories for the show. We just kept hitting these roadblocks, you know, because, for example, like episode 2, we had this marshal. We knew we wanted to kill the marshal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great story. We knew it was going to be a euthanasia story, all of this stuff. And we knew that him and Kate were going to have a backstory. And then the B story for that episode was like Hurley digs a latrine or something. It was really lame. And we realized that it's hard to come up with a number of compelling stories that are going to carry the equal dramatic weight while being serialized and all that. And it was during that point, and this was like before the upfronts. I mean, we're talking about May. So, you know, the show is expected to be understood by its creators as what it's going to be. And within that think tank, we came up with this idea, hey, the pilot has flashbacks. Why don't we do flashbacks in the series?
Your father's told us all about you.
Yeah, what's he told you about me? What'd you tell him about me, Dad? That your son never really had it. Not like the old man. I didn't have the will to make it work. My life, my job, my marriage. What'd you tell him about my marriage, Dad? You know how he manages his marriage? A bottle of scotch every night before dinner.
And it was one of those things where, like, literally minds exploded, and we took all of that detail that we had built up over months of brainstorming and made it part of the series.
You have this great story that you tell in Shoot That One about an incident that occurred in your neighborhood dog park.
Yeah.
Can you share that story with us?
Well, you know, it's like people ask, when did you know Lost was huge or all of that? For me, the biggest sort of version of the power of Lost that I can give you is, so I go to my dog park, and there was this very nice guy who had this dog who was dying of acute canine leukemia. He was a very nice man. You know, his dog was just a sack of bones. I mean, he literally was like a bag of brown fur holding a bunch of bones, and the dog was very tired and very sick. But the guy every day would bring the dog in, and, you know, I got to know him, and I got to know the dog, and he'd let the dog play, and then every once in a while, the dog would just sort of conk out and just lie on the ground, but he would sit there with his dog, and, you know, I'm sitting at the park bench with him for a moment, you know, and we're talking about the dog, and I'm like, look, I'm really sorry, because I'd seen this guy for weeks, you know, and he goes like, yeah, I'm sorry too, and I said, you know, he's not just a great dog, he has a great owner, and then the guy broke down, and then I cried, and then we cried, and then we stopped crying, and there was this awkward moment where we're sitting across this bench from each other, and all we know from each other is that, you know, he has a dying dog, and I'm very sympathetic to his cause. So out of this awkward moment, he says, what do you do for a living? And I said, oh, I'm one of the writers of Lost. And literally his eyes saucered out and he shouts, he goes like, oh my God, can you tell me what's happening on that island? And I was like, yep, the power of Lost right there. You know, I mean, look, I'm happy that we took his mind off of something awful that was going on in his life. And it was really validating for me that even in this tragedy, you know, the guy was so excited about the show.
After Lost, you worked as a co-executive producer for the supernatural drama Medium, starring Patricia Arquette, and then you executive produced and created your own TV series called The Middleman.
That's correct.
Can you tell me about The Middleman?
Well, The Middleman was a script I wrote in 1998, and my agent hated it, and my ex-wife hated it, and I divorced my ex-wife. I kept my agent. But, you know, it was one of those scripts. I had written it as a response to a lot of the shows that were on TV because there was this sort of trope in the 90s that heroism destroyed your life, you know. Buffy's mom died. Buffy's boyfriend is a vampire who has no soul. Every superhero show in the late 90s seemed to be coming out of the darkness of the 80s into a greater darkness that implied that heroism was a life-destroying pursuit and a huge sacrifice. You know, in my experience, doing the right thing usually reaps a lot of benefits, and I wanted to write a show, you know, that was optimistic and all of that, and I did. And, you know, ultimately, because of a guy that I met in the Lost think tank, a guy named Paul Dini, who was very big in independent comics and also in DC Comics. He was the creator of Harley Quinn, for example.
Didn't he work on the Batman animated series, too?
Absolutely. He was one of the writers of that, and he was a huge voice in that world. And he sort of coached me through how to do an independent comic. So, you know, I found an artist who was wonderful, a guy named Les McLean. We put together a pitch. We sold the comic book. It was published by a comic book company. And then around the time that I left Lost, around the time I was doing Medium, I started shopping it to TV networks. And ABC Family, which has since transformed itself into Freeform, took it on. And I remember saying things to them like, guys, the pilot features a gorilla with a machine gun. And they're like, yeah, we know. And I'm like, it's not a metaphorical gorilla. It's a real gorilla in a tracksuit with a machine gun. And they're like, we know. And I'm like, are you sure you want to make this show? And they're like, yep. And I'm like, wow, I found my network, you know?
Get your filthy paws off of me, you damn dirty ape!
And people always ask me, like, why would you do a show about zombie fish and crazy sort of Mexican wrestlers?
Why is my car being surrounded by a bunch of Lucha Libre wrestlers?
That is a very long story for another day, my impudent young weasel.
and a ghost sorority sisters and things like that, you know, at ABC Family. It seemed like that was the really wrong venue for it. And I'm like, no, it wasn't, because they let me make a show as bat insane as that, you know?
The premise is very intriguing. The title character, he's like a freelance fixer of exotic problems.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about
that? It's basically Gilmore Girls meets Men in Black. You try to get in a situation when you create characters where the characters have a huge core conflict that could drive the show forever. And this was a girl who was an artist who was snarky, you know, had a lot in common with like Daria, that kind of character. And she winds up working a job with the world's squarest square that ever squared. The middleman was literally Joe Friday.
You know how in comic books there's all kinds of mad scientists and aliens and androids and monsters?
In comic books, sure.
Well, it really does work like that.
And you're the superhero?
I never wear tights.
And he owes a lot to Joe Friday, as essayed by Dan Aykroyd in Dragnet. I just wanted to create a show that had an airframe that could support every absurd thing that we could imagine within the rubric of, this is the guy who takes care of keeping reality normal. And it's one of those things, you know, people always say like, oh, aren't you sad it got canceled after 12 episodes, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm shocked we got to make the thing in the first place, you know? And I'm shocked that it exists as a DVD. People can find it. You know, it's out there.
Yeah. Your latest book, Shoot That One, contains the mean version of the 11 laws of show running.
Yes, the mean version.
Yeah. And in this essay, you attack the toxic culture that runs rampant behind many TV series. Can you talk a little bit about the toxicity that you've experienced working in TV and why you feel it was important to speak out and write about it?
Yeah, look, on its most subjective level, it boils down to this. TV writers are not known for their managerial acuity or their willingness to share. Writing tends to be a solitary job. It tends to be a job that mystifies itself. It tends to be a job that, look, a lot of us writers are clinical depressives. We have daddy issues or mommy issues or teacher issues or whoever abused us when we were kids. We come into writing with a great deal of baggage. And the hardest part for writers to divest themselves of is the notion that the negative traits in their personality, their monsters, their demons, all the things that run around their heads when the lights go out, we have to accept that those are not the things that drive our creativity, you know? And one of the things that happens when you take a writer and you make him a showrunner or her a showrunner is not just a head writer. A showrunner is the CEO of a corporation with 150 employees and a multi-million dollar budget. And it has a job which is to turn in anywhere from 10 to 22 artisanally created pieces of art. A showrunner needs to be the benign leader of that organization. And what a lot of showrunners mistakenly believe is that by being given a series that the world has validated their, quote, process, unquote, you know? And to a lot of showrunners, that means whatever pain I have to drag myself through, whatever psychosis I have to relive, whatever trauma of my childhood I have to revisit on myself, I get to revisit on others so that they may suffer as I have, and that's how the show's going to get made. And it's just not true. And honestly, the television industry is very results-driven, so they don't care how many writers are abused. You know, and look, the Me Too era, under the rubric of a lot of the sexism that's also rampant, has exposed just how much a lot of showrunners just think that it's all about them and just think that because they have this vision that they can basically do whatever they want. And that's just not the case. It is the case a lot of the time, actually. It's normal for it to be the case, but it shouldn't be. We should be in the business of teaching other artists to be great artists and then letting them be great artists.
You mentioned the Me Too movement, and that was a question I wanted to ask you. Are things getting any better in TV writers' rooms in the wake of the Me Too movement?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they are, and I think they aren't. I keep getting asked the question, and it's a really interesting question because as a Latino, I also get this a lot. It's like, when is it going to be over? When will there be enough representation? And my answer is always this. There will have been enough representation when a female writer or a person of color writer doesn't remember a time when they felt unrepresented, you know? I'm not going to ever feel that there's enough representation because I remember growing up in a media environment where Puerto Ricans were drug dealers and then slowly we worked our way up being the sidekick who gets killed by the villain to show that the bad guy means business and to galvanize the white protagonist. Look, they finally got a Puerto Rican in Star Wars and what does he do? Ruin it for everybody. I mean, you know, I hear Benicio's in Star Wars. Yeah. Oh my God, that's awesome. Oh, he betrayed everybody because he's a nihilist. That's great. And that's looking at it through my lens of having have this experience of not watching myself represented. Someday there'll be a Puerto Rican kid or a Puerto Rican man my age writing for television who goes, yeah, of course you have Puerto Rican leads on TV. And that's when there'll be enough. And I think with Me Too, it's the same thing. When will the movement end? The movement ends when literally the last person dies who remembers being sexually harassed in the workplace and not being sexually harassed in the workplace is the norm. Is it getting better? Yeah. And then it gets worse. And then it gets better. And then it gets a little better. And then it gets a lot worse. And then it lurches forward a little bit. It'll never be fast enough and it'll never be enough change. But, you know, we'll get there because I have to believe, as Dr. King said, that the arc of the universe bends toward morality. I just might not be alive to see it. That doesn't mean we can just stop.
Javier Grillo Marx Watch is a television writer, producer, and showrunner. He's also the author of Shoot That One. Find out more about Javier and his upcoming shows at WPR.org/beta.
And then there's a scene in the book where she sees skulls coming out of the wall, and that was based on what had happened to me in class, which was very alarming if you're sitting in class and all of a sudden you start seeing skulls coming out of the wall.
Juliet Escoria talks about her debut novel, Juliet the Maniac. That's coming up on Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.